All right, so I think it's fitting that Sir Michael and Lady Lorette open this up on Tuesday night as the program co-chairs. So I guess it's time for them to conclude Tier 1 and to look ahead to next year. So, Sir Michael.
You can see I did make notes. Our Brazilian colleague got the blood flowing by teaching us to do the samba. I'm going to do it by covering 2,500 years of intellectual history. And if that doesn't get the remaining third of you to clear out quickly, I can't imagine what would. A conversation with Hans Reiss this morning got me thinking about happiness. Happiness, what's that got to do with anything? I'll come to the point in just a moment. By the way, I feel this is splendid. Thank you. If business is about anything other than just greed and naked self-interest, business would justify what it does as doing something for the population. And this, of course, goes back to Adam Smith's famous phrase, and I'll repeat it. It's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own self-interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love. Nobody but a beggar chooses to depend chiefly upon the benevolence of his fellow citizen. And that set the intellectual climate more or less till today. But, you know, people who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. Recently, for reasons I can't quite defend or explain, I read John Maynard Keynes' The End of Laissez-Faire, which was based on a lecture he gave, I think, about 1920. And in this magisterial sweep of intellectual history, he talked about Adam Smith and he talked about Jeremy Bentham. And he said that somehow or other they managed to take the self-interest of Adam Smith and combine it with the utilitarianism of Jeremy Bentham and claim that self-interest would contribute to the greatest good for the greatest number, which we measure as happiness. And John Maynard Keynes said, we breathe that. It's in the very air that we breathe. We don't question that assumption. But he, of course, questioned it. This was the end of World War I. Germany had its hyperinflation. The world economy was in a mess. And he said, it's the end of laissez-faire. It hasn't worked as an intellectual doctrine. It just doesn't work. I'm not sure that Keynes knew the term neoliberalism, but the critiques of neoliberalism were actually written by Keynes in the 1920s. He understood all this because it didn't work. Then we forgot it. We forgot the Great Depression of the 1930s. We forgot all of that, and we assumed that the naked pursuit of self-interest would be good for the well-being of the population. And what a pity that we forgot our history. Business is absolutely essential to our lives, absolutely vital. This beautiful garment comes from business. My clothes come from business. I wouldn't like a command economy delivering clothes to me. A market is the best way to deliver match goods and people, not public goods. Not public goods. So we depend on business, and the genius-like insight of Adam Smith is absolutely vital. But what I heard starting yesterday morning was that there's another part of ourselves, the selfless part, social business. What I didn't hear is how we marry up the Adam Smith-like appeal to our naked self-interest and how we then pursue social business, that selfless part of ourselves. So I want to divert, as I say, this conversation with Hans made me think about happiness. So let me go even further back to Aristotle, Aristotle talked about two types of well-being, hedonic and eudaimonic. Hedonic, as its name suggests, was the pursuit of well-being, happiness. And eudaimonic has much more to do with greater, deeper satisfaction. A life well lived is closer to eudaimonic well-being. The hedonic is the pursuit of pleasure. Now, John Stuart Mill, this was all stimulated by this discussion. John Stuart Mill, who thought of himself as a utilitarian, but in a famous phrase, which I, because I couldn't get onto the internet, I couldn't look up, but it was something along the lines of saying, which would you rather be, an unhappy man or a happy pig? An unhappy wise man or a happy fool? And John Stuart Mill was in no doubt at all that that deeper sense of satisfaction that comes with wisdom, or that comes with humanity rather than being a pig, was preferable. So although he professed to be a utilitarian, a Benthamite, the greatest good for the greatest number, without any idea of what that good consisted of, just happiness, and regardless of distribution, you just add it up, forget about the way it's distributed. In fact, John Stuart Mill privileged a certain sort of well-being, deep satisfaction. And I speculated last night at dinner, and it is a speculation. Well, part of it's evidential and part of it's speculation. The evidence part, when people do studies on happiness, if you buy a new television, your happiness goes up very briefly, then comes down again. You get back to the hedonic treadmill. You're on this treadmill, so you buy your flat screen television and then it comes back to where it was before. This wonderful statistic, in the United States, there are more radios than there are ears. How many more radios do we need? How many more televisions do we need? If the last television you bought was your fifth television, how much extra happiness is it going to give you? Now, suppose you were involved either in the Adam Smith type business, where but you had in had regard to stakeholder type capitalism, had regard to the well-being of your employees, your impact on the community, on sustainable development, or in the selfless type of business, where you're actually creating the well-being of the population. I mean, I've never been so moved by discussion of excrement as I was when Dr. Jha made his presentation. It was before lunch, but which slight problem, but I've never been so moved, because they're creating good for people at no profit, but creating good for people. Now, I wonder how much satisfaction you get if you compare, well, I made a lot of money today so I can buy another television, or I relieved hundreds of thousands of people from the most demeaning work imaginable and created a better future for them. My guess is the satisfaction, the deep satisfaction, the John Stuart Mill, the unhappiness of the wise man rather than the happiness of the pig, leads to a much, oops, it's just timed out, I better stop. Leads to a much deeper set of satisfaction, sort of satisfaction and happiness, than that momentary boost you get from another consumer good or counting a bit more money. So as we think about the future, we heard a lot over the last 2 days about capitalism at the crossroads, about how we've got to do things differently. It seems to me that harnessing the power of business to create good for the population is a most important thing that we've left out. I said this on the first evening, that the Commission on Social Determinants of Health said almost nothing about business. But harnessing the power of business for social good has to be a most important way forward. I don't underestimate the difficulties. I don't imagine that large corporations are all going to say, well, forget the stock market, forget the Wall Street Journal, we're all going to do things differently now. I don't imagine for one moment that that's how it's going to be. But I wonder if we couldn't seize the opportunity, if we couldn't seize the opportunity of the economic crisis, of the need to do something about sustainable development, about the recognition and understanding of the underserved and the underprivileged. So this is really naive now, and let me, I'm going to write a book about in praise of naivete. Mary Robinson, the sainted Mary Robinson, came to the big meeting we had in London on the closing the gap in a generation about the commission, and she was pushing me to take human rights seriously as part of social determinants of health, and I said, I don't get it. She said, I'll be back in London next Monday. Come and talk to me. So I cycled off to her hotel, and we're having this conversation, and at one point she interrupted me and she said, God bless you, you're naive. And I thought, well, I would never have started doing what I've been doing with WHO and the Commission had I not been naive. So in praise of naivety, let's have two clear messages to end this. One is about the importance of health as an endpoint of the activities of all our social and economic activities, be they business, government, third sector, civil society, and the other is fairness. Because I would argue that if we get fairness in our social and economic activities, we'll get better health and we'll get a fairer distribution of health. And what could be more important than that? Thank you.
I love working with the most visionary in health. We have them with 2 days, for 2 days, and they do translate better than I can do for coming from business how it is possible to actually mainstream the social determinant or mainstream health into economic activity or into business activity that are outside of the standard economic model. We have in examining the business that could contribute to health and wealth for all, over the last 2 days, I think that we have seen a few things. We have seen that there are those emerging models of capitalism which won't change the world from one day to the next, but that are moving us toward being more conscious and more in the deeds, not just in the words, about what as business, as corporation, on the private sector side, can be done, whether it is for contributing to healthy workplaces, whether it is to contributing to various facets of the living of population. And we have also seen through the social business that we have been talking a lot and that Michael have been pursuing further, we have also seen that in doing social goods, in doing taking care of acting upon the selfless side of our life, there is also a need to do so in a very focused and action-oriented way. And I think that within that perspective, if we come back from the where we started at the beginning with those convergence workshop and saying that basically at the platform, slowly but safely, we do want to build network, convergence network to push science, policy, action, and education. And on each of the four teams that we have been discussing and talking about over the last 2 days or 3 days, there are concrete steps that have been suggested and that we will be processing and coming and moving forward. One on which we all partner would like to work in a collaborative manner is to try to get, it is indeed a great opportunity that we have in the present of having the G8 and the G20 here in Canada in the coming year. And the idea is that if we were to build upon the networks of partners here in Canada as partners, we have going from city level, Montreal, Quebec, McGill just happened to be in Quebec, and Canada, we have basically the whole levels of public health agency being involved. We had not just Quebec, but we have over the 3 days, we had colleagues coming from the various provinces. We also, among the partner with Grameen, Grameen, the Creative Lab, with also the Fédération des Caisses Populaires des Jardins, with the partner from agriculture, we are convinced that if we work together, we should be able to try to get health and economic convergence first on the agenda of the G8, of the G20, but most importantly, in the everyday life and everyday strategy of individual and business. And I know I've been giving a lot of work to all of you over the last year and over the last few days. I will not take more of your time. It's already 6 o'clock. I do thank all, I thank my co-chair, Michael, Wendy, I don't know if she's here. I thank all of our partners and also all the numerous members of the advisory groups and of the executive program committee. As you see, if you look at the members of our advisory group, we have a good number of them who are coming from different sectors who are in key position to driving the change on the ground. So the thing that you have seen here over the last 2 or 3 days is just the beginning of a think and do things. And we, within each of those teams, with our partner and also with the broader dissemination that we plan to do, we do want to play a leading role both in here in Canada but also worldwide, because the global world that we have to change and realign a bit to be, to present less challenge to biology and to culture, it has to be changed one day at a time, one action at a time, and working from the individual to community, to the country, and to the world, as a matter of fact. So I will stop here. Thanks all of you. I will also would like to thanks, as we call them, the gang in the back, Neely, if you want to, you can stand up. Neely, Natalia, and MC, Marie-Claire. Thank you so much, and thank you, and have a Pascal, oh, sorry, and Aida. Thank you. And the last but not the least, Peter. Thank you so much.